From St. Louis, Missouri, this is Strangers to Fiction, a podcast about documentary storytelling by two documentary filmmakers. My name's Bill Streeter.
And I'm Jacob McIndollar, and today we're going to look at the 2002 Academy Award-nominated documentary, Spellbound.
Harry, turn toward the microphone and let's finish the word, please.
Okay, then.
Let's see, what do I've got so far?
Epitaph.
Here's another one, look.
I can't even pronounce these words.
Repetiteur.
You can know every single word in a round but one.
And get that one.
Chateaubriand.
We went on for, I think, 11 or 12 rounds.
Well, I got on stethoscope.
City last found me. Now I'm going to the nationals.
My baby!
My baby gonna win.
My heart was pounding.
You can't not be nervous.
My hands were clammy.
Well, it's more intense than any competition.
S-T-R-E-S-S.
This one, one letter, and you're out.
Cephalalgia.
Cephalalgia?
A pain in the head. Nephalognosy.
Dysphagia.
Hellebore.
Cyboxy.
Palimpsest.
Neil's grandfather in India has paid 1,000 people to be chanting and praying for Neil to win.
Darjeeling.
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 Can you pronounce the word again, please?
And I felt bad for the boy who was from Texas and got Yenta.
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 Oh, I want to get a word. I actually remember. Oh my gosh, am I right? Am I right?
I-N-E.
That is correct.
You've done 4,000 words and you got one mistake. You're doing good now.
You don't get any second chances in India the way you do in America.
They thought we would have better opportunities. They're just so proud.
My life is like a movie. I go through different trials and tribulations and then I finally overcome.
So, Spellbound. I think my biggest problem with this film was the title.
Really?
Yeah. Only because there's another movie called Spellbound, a fairly famous Alfred Hitchcock film.
But it's a fiction film.
Yeah, of course.
And this is
Movies. There's a lot of movies with the same names out there. That's like one of those things. But I don't know. I feel like it was kind of a cheesy, like hooky name, I guess.
But it's so appropriate for it. I mean, yeah. It's about a spelling bee, and you're kind of spellbound by it.
It's a minor criticism. I'm not holding it against the film. I feel like I like the movie. That, like I said, that's the to me, that's the worst part of this movie.
Did you have any other names in mind? What would have been a better name?
I mean, they could have just called it Spelling Bee, and it would have worked, I feel, you know.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, even marketing-wise, it would have been, you know, just as good. But whatever.
Yeah, I didn't have any issue with the title of it, but
yeah.
I thought we might kind of walk through this. So
yeah,
the film is cut up into basically two sections, right? You have a section where they kind of take you inside the lives of each of the spellers. So I think they're following 8 different spellers, and it's taking place in the 1999. Scripps National Spelling Bee. And so the first half of the film, they take you through, kind of show you their lives, show you what motivates them. You get to see their family. And then the second half is the actual spelling bee, right? It's the actual finals of the National Spelling Bee. And what I really liked about it is the way that they broke that down. You got to know, you know, each one of these characters in there pretty intimately and see what their motivation was. And you found it so interesting, like, you know, I kind of wanted to talk about some of our favorite characters in there, yeah. Right? I mean,
I was gonna ask what your favorites were.
So the one thing that struck me right off the bat on this is like the first character they introduce is a girl named Angela, and she is the, as I understand, She is the daughter of an illegal immigrant, somebody who actually crossed the border. They talk about it in the film. They crossed the border like under the cover of night. He even talks about how some mules, you know, came and took him across the border in the middle of the night. And that was right off the bat very interesting to me, because this is a film that came out in 2002, and then this is such a big political issue that
people are talking about right now. Yeah, it seemed interesting that it seemed very topical. That part of it was very topical, and it was you know, it was really interesting. I felt like one of the minor characters in this film that wasn't a speller, that really actually very compelling, was her brother.
I knew you were going to say that, and I found throughout this film, and what I liked about it so much was you didn't just see the spellers, but you got to see the compelling people in their lives. And a lot of times, and there's a few others that I'd like to talk about later that are like that, but absolutely, her brother was just so interesting to hear him talk, because he had this perspective of being the son of somebody who had kind of come over here illegally. Their father, you know, the part of the irony of this girl going to the National Spelling Bee is that her father doesn't even speak English, right? I think there's a line in there that's something about, like, he says, "I've been talking to cows for 20 years, so why do I need to learn English?"
Yeah, exactly.
Because he works as a farmhand.
Yeah.
But yeah, her brother was very interesting, because he had a really interesting perspective of kind of that first immigrant, like first generation immigrant.
But it was weird, because it's weird to talk about illegal immigration in the context of today's modern approach, the ideas about, because people's, it kind of shows that, like, the people's attitudes, American attitudes towards immigration and illegal immigration, which I'm not a huge fan of that term, but like undocumented immigration, basically, you know, because it felt like that kid had actually internalized the idea that what his dad did was wrong.
Did you think so?
He said that. Like, I can't remember what the line was in the film.
I think what he said was, I think,
and his name is Jorge, by the way.
Jorge is the brother's name.
Yeah.
And I think what he said, if I remember it right, he said that at the time, because I believe the brother, Jorge, was born in Mexico, I believe, and I think he came across the border with him.
Yeah.
And I think he was saying that at the time when it was happening, he had the feeling that they were doing something wrong.
Oh.
Like, because they were kind
Maybe I misread it. Yeah. I thought he was sort of paraphrasing what his dad said. Like, his dad said, "I knew what we were doing was wrong, but I had to do it for my family," or something like that.
Right,
I felt like that was
you could also, though, kind of interpret that a few different ways. I knew it was wrong. Well, wrong on what level? Is it morally wrong, or is it just illegal?
Is Jorge misinterpreting him? You know, he could say, "I knew it was illegal."
Right. And surely the father knew it was illegal.
Or he knew there was a risk in it, maybe even. It could have been what he was saying or what he meant. Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to know. I just felt like, it seemed to me that, like, Jorge just seemed like a typical Texas kid to me in a lot of ways. And the way he talked about illegal immigration, it did sound a little prejudicial, you know? And I felt like he may have internalized sort of American notions of what how immigration is supposed to work, even though he's either a illegal immigrant himself, or he's at least the child of illegal immigrants.
I didn't get that from what he was saying. I kind of got, I felt like, and maybe it was the same thing, but I felt like he carried sort of a heavy burden. You know, he carried this burden, but I think that was a little bit about the pressure.
Yeah. As conflict, like he was internally conflicted about it, which you would be, I guess, if you had internalized the typical redneck American attitude towards illegal immigrants.
See, I took it more as, and we're just, we don't know what the guy was meaning, but I took it more as that he saw what his father had sacrificed in order for them to be where they were in life, and he felt a tremendous amount of pressure to live up to that, to be worthy of his father.
No, I think
that
I agree with that too. You know? I just think I mean, that's the great thing about, this is one of the things I really love about documentary, well-done documentaries, is that the best ones are like, sort of like a good story, they're kind of subject to various levels of interpretation.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? And
and I think you get a lot more of that in documentaries.
Yeah. Because and this film is so good at it.
Yeah.
I feel like.
Because
and I
it
think
just
that's
lets
all
people
in the
be.
Editing. I think it's all in the editing.
It's in the editing, but it's just the way that they let people be, right? There's not a lot of, I mean, you know, reality TV is not documentary, but there's not a lot of, even in documentaries now, some days you'll, some of them you'll see a lot of things that have obviously been set up and staged to get, but this is just going inside of their lives.
Yeah. You know? And just hearing somebody talk. And I love, I feel like, this was obviously not just a typical fly in the wall documentary. I feel like this is like one of those hybrid documentaries. So, you know, there's different styles of documentary filmmaking. There's the talking head and then the B-roll. And then there's like the sort of the fly in the wall. And I feel like a lot of movies these days are kind of a hybrid. They use sort of both of those elements. There was a time when documentary filmmakers were all one school or the other.
Really?
The Maisels brothers, for instance, would never do talking heads in their documentaries.
So that's all just fly on the wall. Maisel brothers are the
Maisels brothers. They did Grey Gardens and Salesman, and they did a Rolling Stones concert film. Well, actually, a concert documentary, which was really good. They've done a few other. David Maisel, I think, just died in 2016. His brother died.
Oh, really?
Maybe 20 years ago.
Because I think that. I don't think I've seen any of their work, but you've talked to me before about the Salesman. And I, from what you had told me, I pictured that much older, but wasn't that done in the
67, 50s? 67.
Yeah. Okay.
It was all black and white, probably for budget. And,
right.
But it was literally, and this is like, you don't see, I mean, I don't want to get off in this film, and you can edit this however you feel, but I feel like, you know, you just don't, that was, it's just such a weird thing to watch that movie. It's almost surreal because you're not, it's over 50 years ago now that film was shot, and it's literally like you don't see fly in the wall footage from the mid 60s. You know, if you do, it's like home movies that are, you know, 2 minutes long. They literally just followed these salesmen around selling Bibles.
And I think about that sometimes, even seeing like this Spellbound is, and this is really stupid, but I always think, man, it's such a shame that the cameras weren't invented earlier.
Yeah.
You know, so that you could see like, I mean, so that's kind of the beginning of maybe where you would get a fly on the wall, but it'd be really interesting.
Yeah, and the reason the Maisels brothers did it was because the technology came along that allowed them to do it.
Right.
You know, I can't remember the name of the Cine. It was a French film, or a French camera. It was the first sync sound that recorded sync sound in the camera.
Right.
And when they used it for news reels and stuff, but like they were able to, and you could carry it, you know, and that came out in the mid 60s. And that's what that technology actually inspired them to do this documentary style of filmmaking, because it was, I don't think it didn't really exist before because of the technology.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Technology suddenly made it possible, and they modified everything. You know, they would jerry-rig their own focus pullers and all kinds of stuff to their cameras and to that camera just to make it work for the way they did it, and built their own harnesses and stuff.
Well, I promise someday I will watch it.
Yeah.
In fact, we'll probably have to talk about it.
Yeah, no, we should talk about it. I don't know. But you can cut all that out if you
want. No, it's fine. But I wanted to go back to the Angela real quick because right from the beginning. So Angela was the first character that they introduced. And I was immediately, and through the rest of the film, she was my favorite.
Angela?
Yeah. She was the one that I was pulling for. I was like, I want her to win when they get there. So yeah, she was my favorite. She was probably my favorite character. Yeah, the girl from Texas. And then
she was sweet.
One of the first questions I had when I watched this was, I need an update, right? I need an update on all of these people.
There's been a few things written about sort of following up with them. I think maybe 5 or 6 years ago, there was a couple of articles that were not a lot written about this film, though. Honestly, I was surprised. There was like, I was looking for, I would like to have, I don't think there's been any published interviews with the filmmaker who actually went on to have a pretty.
Yeah, the filmmaker is, what's his, Jeffrey Blitz?
Yeah.
He went on to do a lot of episodes of The Office and stuff.
Yeah, he was nominated for the Emmy for a number of episodes that he directed. And, you know, he, as far as I know, he hasn't done any other documentary work.
So. No, I don't think so. He did, what is this, Rocket Science?
Yeah. But I would like to, I mean, I would have liked to had some insight into his approach to making this film.
And what made him do it? Like, what got him interested in it?
Yeah. You know? I mean, I couldn't find any of that information out. Yeah. There didn't seem to be any, you know, any interviews about it. I mean, sure, I'm sure he did some press around that period. But
And it's surprising, too, because I don't even think we've mentioned this yet, but this was nominated for an Academy Award.
I know. I know. It was, yeah.
And I think it didn't...
It wasn't an insignificant... And I feel like it was probably the start of his career. I feel like that probably kicked off his career.
I mean, yeah, that's obviously what led to the rest of everything he did after that.
So, but it's interesting, he became a director and hasn't done any other documentaries. I don't know. Maybe we should try to reach out to him and see if he would like to talk to him. Because I would love some insight on this film, you know. Because it was so well done and well edited. I'd like to know some insight in terms of like how his approach. Because he did a really good job of sort of drawing people out and having them talk. And I don't know if he just did that by being around them for a long time and getting them comfortable with him.
Right.
Or, you know, what his technique was, you know?
And there was, and the one thing, one of the things I liked.
It's a hard thing to do.
It is. Yeah. And, but what I liked about the way that he did it was, you know, you were talking about there being the kind of two styles of documentary, the fly on the wall and the talking heads. But there's also
this is a hybrid.
But there's also a style of interview, right?
Yeah.
And some interviewers, some people, you will hear the question, right? You'll hear the interviewer ask the question. And that's some people's. You know, that's their MO. That's what they do. That's what like Roger Ebert does. You know, that's
Earl Morris does it. Earl Morris,
you do hear his questions sometimes, but not always.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I don't know. I feel like the ones where you actually hear the questions always, it's always like a conversational thing or like the sort of news package stuff.
I meant Michael Moore, not Roger Ebert.
Michael Moore. Yeah, so Michael Moore, like Roger me. So yeah. Michael Moore is, I feel like that's even another style of documentary.
It is.
Like, so that's like a hosted documentary.
It is, and there's a lot of staged kind of stuff there.
Yeah, and what's his name? Morgan Spurlock, sort of a host. Well, here's one is a film about a McDonald's.
Supersize Me, yeah.
It was a hosted documentary. It was the filmmaker sort of like a diary style, I guess.
Yeah. You know? There's other examples I can think of that of like Bigger, Stronger, Faster. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah.
And that guy.
But then there's the news documentary, which you see a lot in like, you know, BBC or PBS or even they put the whole, it's like a long form news package. It's not just, you know what I mean by news package?
Yeah.
A lot of people, just for the, in case you don't know what I'm talking about, a package is a term of art that's used by television news production. So those stories that you hear in the 6 o'clock news where they go the anchor desk, the anchor introduces a story and then you see a reporter out in the street, that's called the news package. And there's a very funny parody video that was done by
You're talking about. This is the news. Yeah. This is
And it's sort of like parodies all the, and there's like three or four different things that they do in those and they package them in a very particular way. There's that long form news package style where you have a reporter that goes out and does a story about, you know,
right.
A report about it. It comes off as a news report. So there's that style. There's a fly on the wall. I feel like this movie is a hybrid of the, you know, sort of interview style and the, but the filmmaker's definitely not a character in it.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I mean. Yeah. There's the ones that you have the characters that are a filmmaker and then the ones that are not. And I liked that about this a lot because I felt like it would have ruined just the letting the story tell itself.
Yeah.
If you had somebody who you could hear asking questions and kind of directing things in a way to go.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about another kid, Neil. Neil Kadakia. Do you remember him?
Hang on. I got to look him up.
I can give you.
I know I remember him.
He's the, his dad. About the side characters.
The Indian kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Indian kid and his dad.
Oh my God.
What'd you think about his
dad? His dad was, I would say his dad, I don't think that kid was into it at all.
No?
I mean, he was because he wanted to please his dad, but like his dad was, I hope that kid survived that childhood with that dad.
Well, we talked about updates. I can say he's a very successful real estate guy in California now. Okay. So.
Well, he's real estate though. That's funny. He didn't become a doctor.
But I think he seems to be doing very well.
His dad seemed very success oriented. Like he was very material success.
He did, and here's the thing. The problem that I had with him is I wanted to look at him and go, This is just your stereotypical tiger dad or tiger mom, right? Who's just like, like, you know, Asian, East Asian kind of stereotypes. Yeah, are they just driving their kids to study?
I think that's really a first generation American kind of thing.
Yeah, but the dad was also, but he didn't come across as, I don't know. He seemed very loving. I mean, he seemed like he was doing it out of, he was, you know, he was success motivated, but he seemed very loving. He seemed very proud. Yeah. He didn't seem just like, you know, go, 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 you know, you got to work harder.
And his dad did have a very pragmatic, I mean, to his credit, I feel like he had a very pragmatic approach to the whole idea of the spelling bee. Like he said all, like a couple different ways at a couple different times throughout the film, which I agree with. It's like, you know, so what if he doesn't go all the way? At least he had a really good experience and he learns how to strive for something.
Yeah, he learns how to be successful.
He learns the value of hard work. And, you know, getting to nationals and getting on CNN was, you know, however far you get, it doesn't matter. Like, he wasn't one of these guys, you got to be number one.
Right. Exactly. And that's kind of exactly what when they first introduced him as a character, and him and his son are just sitting on the bed and they're just drilling words. Like the dad just say a word and the son spells it really fast.
Yeah.
And so right when they first introduced him, I was like, oh yeah, this guy is like that. He's one of those, you got to be the best. If you're not the best, blah, blah, you know, but he didn't actually once. And that's what I think is so valuable about seeing about this kind of film is you see a guy like that and you want to sort of label him initially and say, oh, you're this kind of pushy father who doesn't love their kids.
No, yeah. Then when you get obviously more complex than that.
Yeah. When you got a peek inside of him, you go like, you could see that he was driven himself to be like a successful person in life. And he wanted his son to have that same motivation. Yeah. But he was also in a very positive way.
And who knows
way.
What it's like to be, like, we don't know what it's like to be, well, you do, actually.
An immigrant?
I don't know what it's like to be an immigrant to another country where you're really kind of looked at as a very outsider. And Indians are, especially Indians, that accent's people probably, he has a hard time probably getting people to take him seriously.
The father didn't have much of an accent, though.
I thought he did.
Yeah. I didn't really pick up on it too much. He seemed like...
But you know what? He had a very sort of... American sort of affect. It was weird. Yeah. He had a very thick Indian accent, but like the way he spoke about things, it's very American.
And he lived in Southern California.
Yeah.
He had one beautiful home that they lived in, and they showed off another beautiful home that him and his brother were buying and remodeling and stuff.
I'm probably super wealthy now.
Yeah. So, they it was a very successful family.
You know what I found really ironic was that like that kid was so prepared. And the one word that fucked him up, almost fucked him up, was an Indian. Well, he had.
Right. It was Darjeeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I actually thought about that during the film. I remember Googling it and going, isn't that an Indian?
He was so and this is what it told me. That kid was so immersed in like learning English, standard English spelling, that he completely forgot his own culture.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't imagine that he was ever exposed that much to the culture. He did. Yeah. I think he grew up in the States. And his sister was also... Yeah. A spelling bee girl, like she had gone through. She wasn't in that year, but she had been in like ones previously. So you just got that feeling that whole family was driven to succeed and be successful. Yeah. Even the mother, they introduced the mother a little bit in there, and even she kind of was on the board of like, you know, they need to, you know, learn the value of, you know, what it takes to succeed.
Yep.
And when you compare her, or compare that family to Angela, the one we were talking about before.
Yeah.
When I would watch
another Angela, immigrant family from a different part of the world.
You're right, it is, she didn't have any, you know, like I looked at her and said, what is her motivation? Mm-hmm. Why is she wanting to succeed in this? Because she didn't have family members like drilling her like Neil's father was drilling him. Like, you know, she was just, it was just something she was into. You know, she liked it and she wanted to be good at it. And, you know, so it was very interesting to see the two different sides of that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't know. There's so much to pick apart in this film. I think that's what makes it so good, you know?
And these people, the characters are so interesting. Like, you couldn't really... I mean, it's cliche to say you couldn't write these characters. No. But you really couldn't.
Yeah.
Like, there was the other...
I could see it being kind of a jumping off point for a fictionalized series, though. You could almost,
sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, there was a film that came a little bit later, Aquila and the Bee, I think was the name of it, or Kayla, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but that was... And I read about this during, you know, going through this, that the Spellbound inspired the screenwriter to write that based off of Spellbound.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it's about a... I believe it's about a young black girl. I think she's fairly impoverished. I haven't actually seen the film, but and then she gets involved in the spelling bee, right? And sort of overcoming those obstacles of being from a background that might not necessarily put a lot of emphasis on education.
White, the Ashley White character in this film.
Yeah, the Ashley White character. Yeah. Yep. And the Ashley White character, and I was going to talk about her too, but. I found her mother very interesting. Like, just all these side characters are so interesting. Yeah. And you could see her mother was, just having her basic struggles with life, like taking care of everything.
Yeah.
And just like almost looking at her daughter going like, where did this come from? Like, she's so amazing. How did, where did this come from?
Yeah. And, that was a pretty sad story because you could tell she was probably just as capable as all the other kids, but she just didn't have... she didn't have the dad that was going to drill words with her or hire a tutor for her,
But, I mean, that was the same thing with Angela. I mean, you did have an interesting mix here of the kids who seemed self-motivated versus the kids who were being sort of, guided into it.
Yeah. I mean, Angela didn't have a lot of that stuff either.
Right.
Those are the two that were very... probably had the most obstacles to overcome in terms of, but one thing Angela had that Ashley didn't was she had a mom and a dad at home, and she had a an older sibling that probably helped a lot,
right?
I bet Ashley didn't really have that.
Yeah,
Ashley just had her mom, and she was probably working two jobs or something.
Well, she did. We should say she did have a teacher, right?
Yeah. Oh, she had a teacher that was in her corner. Yeah.
Yeah, she had a specific teacher who was like working with her, that like one on one. She would sit there and practice.
Yeah.
And I remember they said like. The teacher said something along the lines of, I asked somebody, like, how do I even prepare for the National Spelling Bee? They said, just start reading the dictionary.
Yeah.
And so that's what they did. They just had the dictionary out, and they were just going through it and drilling different words.
Yeah. That's.
What did you make of Harry?
Harry was hilarious. I liked him. He was almost like the comic relief in the film,
He was the comic relief in the film. And when you read like different reviews about it and stuff, they always say like he's the most interesting,
He was the one that Roger Ebert liked the best.
Yeah.
I don't know if he was my favorite. I mean, I understand. I mean, that's why I'd like to talk to the filmmaker, because I feel like the film was kind of perfect in so many ways in terms of like the balance of characters. Did they shoot more people?
I believe they did. There were a couple of others that they
sort of, and then did they sort of pick and choose which would make the best story in post?
Yeah, from my understanding, I think there was two others.
How did he follow that many people? Really? Did he send out multiple crews?
That's a good question.
Did he do advanced, just random? Like, did he visit different family every other month? And if he did more than that's expensive traveling.
Yeah, I thought about that too, because I mean, each when you're introduced to each character, it starts with basically a title screen that says where you're at, San Bernardino, California.
Yeah. So if they
Texas,
did more, if they recorded students that we never saw in the film, then they spent a lot of time shooting stuff.
Yeah, and a lot of travel. That is interesting. Like, did this guy go out and do it all himself a bunch of crews? I remember reading somewhere, and I was trying to find it.
I couldn't find any information about the background of this film at all.
Like, but I thought I read somewhere that...
If you did, then...
There had been two other characters who were filmed but didn't end up being included in the film.
Interesting. Okay, so there were only two more, but still, that's a lot.
Yeah, I think they did a total... I mean, it's 10...
Yeah.
10 different locations, 10 different people
that's
to
a
introduce.
Lot. So. Yeah.
But Harry is very, very quirky, I guess you would call it. He does a lot of like kind of fidgeting.
Yeah, and
he's
real fidgety. But that's typical of a kid his age. Like, he was, 11?
I guess I was thinking.
I have an 11-year-old at home, and he's super I think a lot of boys that age just kind of have that about them,
I wondered if there was something undiagnosed. But
there may have been. I mean, may have had like some little, kind of autism or tics or something. But I don't know. I feel like a lot of kids his age, kind of had. He was the only kid that was about 10 years old.
Yeah, he looked like the youngest.
Yeah.
Was he the youngest?
Yeah. He was 11. He was the youngest of all of them. And I just feel like kids that age are That's a weird age, you know. It's a fun age. I'm a parent of a child that's about that age now, and they're hilarious to be around, and they're so much fun. But it's a little, you know, it's just pre-puberty, you know. It's right before they turn into wacky teenagers, you know. Yeah. But they're still kind of, they got a lot of that little kid in them. Mm-hmm. But they're super intelligent, and they're
figuring out the world, you know. Yeah, you could see that in him. He had a lot of, like, just that quirkiness still left in him. And on that threshold of between being a little kid. Like, my kids, like, I watch them, like, it seems like they're not in control of themselves a lot of times. Like, they'll just have, like, a one hand over here, like, playing with something, one hand over here, like, doing something.
Yeah, well, they're having a sensory experience, and they're learning about the world, and they're learning about their body still, you know, and that's what makes little kids so fun, I think, is that they kind of have that sense of wonder that we don't have as adults. You sort of lose that as an adult. And so
did you have any other particular characters that you wanted to talk about? Any that stood out to you?
Well, what about the girl who won?
Who did win?
Was it April? It was Noopur Lala.
Oh, yes. Oh, right. Noopur Lala. So she ended up being the champion. She won with the word Logaria. And,
Yep. And I thought that was interesting because that was an interesting insight into the actual contest itself that surprised me, because I don't know spelling bees. I don't know how they work, but apparently the rule is if both the two finalists missed their last word, then it's a tie.
Okay.
So in order to actually win the contest, you get one more word and you have to get it right. And then that makes you the winner.
I gotcha.
So
now she was interesting too, because also Indian family.
Yeah.
Very different approach from the parents.
Yeah.
And I remember even, like, so as you're watching the film, you obviously don't know that she's going to be the winner, right?
Yeah.
But to me, she sort of came across as one of the least interesting characters.
Yeah.
But not for any bad reason, just because, like, her parents were super great. Like, they were supportive, but they also weren't pushing her.
Yeah.
She didn't seem
to be... It was just something she wanted to do, I think.
Yeah, and she didn't seem to be... I mean, there were some of these kids that put a lot of pressure on themselves of, like, I want to win. She didn't really seem to put even a whole lot of pressure on herself.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think she kind of had this, like, side that didn't come out necessarily in her, because they interviewed those kids that she was in.
Oh, yes. Those kids were another example of the great, like, side characters.
And
those
so three awkward, kids. Too.
Those yeah, and that was awkward. Great. It was how awkward they were. But you're right. But
they were all, like, they all sort of, I mean, that was part of their thing, was that, like, they all testified to the fact that she was super competitive, you know, and right. she had to win.
Yeah. Like, they were like, we tried really hard, and we practiced really hard, but they're like, you just can't beat her.
Yeah.
You just can't beat her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they talked about her competitive side. Like, they just said, you know, she was not going to lose. Like, she was just, you know.
So. And it's really interesting, because it didn't seem like her family definitely didn't seem to be pushing her in that way. That was just an internal motivation that she seemed to have. Yeah. Like, just, I want to be the best.
Yeah. And then, there are a couple other notable things about some of the other spellers. Ted Bingham.
Yeah, Ted's a sad story.
Yeah, he died.
He died. And he was
a few years later.
Yeah, not too much longer. And Ted was really interesting, because Ted seemed like the most...
He's from Missouri.
He was from Missouri, which is where we're from. But he also seemed the most sort of out of place there. And I remember him talking about, like... like, in his school, he lived in, I guess, kind of a rural Missouri area. Mm-hmm. Basically lived on a farm. They had chickens and stuff. And
two brothers.
And his parents seemed really nice and all of that. But he would talk about how, like, oh, I can't relate to the kids in my school because, you know.
He's smart.
I'm smart, basically, so it was like a kid who.
But I kind of felt like he might have had someone diagnosed, maybe, like, some form of autism, maybe. I don't know.
Potentially, yeah.
I mean, that's how he came off to me.
Yeah,
I mean, or at least he had, like, someone diagnosed, maybe, what do you call it? Like, social anxiety, you know, like, really severe social anxiety, and that he just, you know. But a lot of kids that age, he was 13, 14, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. most 13, 14 year olds are really socially awkward anyway, so it's hard to know if that was like a chronic
social anxiety. And he seemed like a pretty big kid for his age. He probably felt a little bit awkward in his own body as well. Yeah. But he just seemed the most sort of, he was a really smart kid.
Yeah, he just seemed sad. Though,
yeah, he did seem sad.
And I wonder, you know, his family never really, and I don't want to speculate out of respect to them.
Sure.
But, you know, you wonder if we were seeing something there that maybe later led to his death. I don't know. You don't know.
Yeah, I mean, and that was kind of my thought, too. Yeah. I mean, I kind of understand what you're saying, but I was, I did look it up, and I was interested, and I did read the same thing, that the family never released any information on what happened.
I think he went to medical school in Kansas City or something.
Oh, did he?
I think so.
Oh, yeah, it says he attended medical school in Kansas City until he died in 2007.
Yeah.
So we talked about, I said earlier I wanted to do some updates.
Yeah.
So I have some updates.
All right.
We talked about Neil.
Yeah.
So Neil is in real estate now in California. I imagine, you know, I was thinking about
his dad must have been a real estate developer or something.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. I think he went into the family business.
Yeah.
We talked about Angela, or sorry, about Ashley. Yeah. Ashley, I guess, went to study at Harvard or Howard University, not Harvard University. I don't know what she's done since then. Harry, little quirky Harry's got a PhD in mathematics.
Of course he does.
Yes, he does. He seems like he would have a PhD in
mathematics. I would like to see what he's like.
I know. I would love to see if he's, as an adult, like if he's still got that quirkiness. Because, you know, like a guy with a PhD in mathematics might still have that quirkiness. Maybe. It might be fun.
Maybe.
Angela has a PhD in Hispanic studies. I think she's a professor now. And Nuparlala. She studied medicine.
Yeah. Well, apparently MTV wanted to do a reality show around her, but she turned that down.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, imagine being the winner of the spelling bee and the star of this, like, documentary, and then you go on to, like, completely wrong direction in your life, and you become an MTV reality star. So good for you for turning that down. I guess the only other one we didn't, or there are a couple of people we didn't talk about, but I don't know if I have a lot to say.
Emily Stagg.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember who Emily was.
Yeah, I have a hard time remembering her, too. It's been like over a week since I've seen
her. Yeah, me too. And
apparently she didn't make a big impression.
But she, she was in sixth. And then April, I'm trying to remember who April was. She placed third. And she went on to study New York University degree in journalism. So, yeah.
Emily Stagg. I remember her. Yeah.
Refresh my memory.
She's dark hair. She had real dark hair, I think. I'm not getting good bandwidth here for some reason.
Man, they got to chill with the chairs upstairs.
No, that never stops.
Really? What is that?
It's just a store. It's a store.
Oh, that's the store.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sometimes I hear people yelling. It's worse, actually, in the next office over.
Yeah, I just worry about the mics. So.
No, it's fine. I can barely hear it. I can't hear that stuff at all.
So do you have, any final thoughts on this?
Not that I can think of. I was going to see. I'm not getting this page load. I was going to say something about Emily Stagg. I just want to confirm that she was the same person I'm thinking of. It's fine. I you know what? It's a good movie. I highly recommend people watch it. The one other thing I would add about it was it's interesting to see. You know, it's very rudimentary. This was a film that was made on video. It's a video documentary. I think.
Is it real? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was shot on. Did I say film?
You said video.
Yeah, it was a documentary that was shot. You'll have to edit this.
It's fine.
It was a. So this is a documentary that was made on early 2000s professional, I assume, video technology. So it was shot on video, not film. So it has that video look to it. It looks like a. You know, and I feel like it might look a little dated relative to modern.
I think it looks a little dated even for its time.
Maybe, Maybe. And you know, I feel like some of the graphics and the titles and stuff in between the way they divided up mm-hmm. the different sections. I'm not a big fan. I wasn't big. I mean, I felt very.
I here's my thing.
Low budget, early 90s.
Like, it felt like that to me too, but I just didn't give a shit.
No, I didn't.
Because the film was so good, I didn't care movie, about any of that.
Yeah, it sort of, it surpassed its flaws.
And these days I see a lot of.
And what I was going to say was, like, even though it feels like a dated film, technically, the story transcends all that. The story is such a good film that it transcends. And I feel like it's a good example of when people get, and it really bugs the shit out of me when filmmakers get super hung up, especially with documentaries, get super hung up on the technical stuff. And it's like, yeah, it's great to have a really beautiful documentary, but the story is always the most important thing.
Well, you're hitting a nerve for me, because that's one of the things there's too much focus on the graphics and different kind of flashy elements in it. I'm taken out of the story.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like that's bad editing, right?
Yeah.
Good editing.
That's people that want to show off how well they know
exactly.
how to edit.
Exactly. The good editing, a good editor knows like how to keep the focus on the story. That's the whole point.
And you serve the story, yeah.
And it doesn't matter how good you feel like those graphics look. If you have a really beautiful piece of film and it doesn't fit in the story anywhere, you can't use it.
Yeah.
You cannot use that. Hmm. If you cannot get it in a way that supports a story, it doesn't need to be there. You know?
I agree 100%. Well, I think my final thought would be I loved this film. I loved it right from the beginning. I was like, I just was like kind of sucked into that world.
Yeah,
and I sat
they
there.
Did a good job with that, like sort of, oh, there's a name for this in television. And it is a television technique where you take a piece of some character or something from the story and you tease something that's going to happen later in the film at the very beginning. Because mm-hmm. they opened with Harry at the beginning, making those faces.
Oh, did even they? Before I forgot about that. Okay.
Even before the titles. And I feel like that helped draw people in. Because I feel like just seeing him try to spell a word, you know it's a spelling bee. Yeah. You know he's under a lot of pressure.
Yeah, you know the time, the place, you know the setting.
And he's this little kid that's like, you kind of instantly have like an affinity for or sympathy for. And it does a really good job of drawing you into the film, even though he doesn't really show up for another like 45 minutes.
Right.
Again.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah.
Okay, that's a great point. And that's why the point I was going to make about my final thought, and just with all of that together, is I wish that this guy had made more documentaries.
Yeah.
I think he did a fantastic job.
Yeah. And I'd like to see him do another one. Should do another one.
I mean, there's no shame in directing episodes of The Office. And like you said, he got
I understand why he does that, because that pays a lot better than documentaries.
Yeah, and he did 11 different episodes of The Office. He did a show called
The Review. TV directors get paid on that level?
Oh, they get paid very well, right?
You know what I worked with a guy that was a TV director for a minute. Yeah, he told me.
We might not want to say that on the podcast.
No, it's fine. but you can edit it however you feel. But they average about $50,000 per episode, and they'll get signed for maybe 4 or 5 episodes per season. So you know, $250,000 a year.
It's a good gig,
and usually I think each, depending on the, I think The Office probably is a week long commitment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's $50,000 for a week's worth of work.
Jeez.
You work 5 weeks a year and make $250,000.
Oh, that's nice.
So, I don't blame him for doing.
No, not at all. But I do wish, I do wish he would
feel like a job like that. He has some spare time. He could be doing some.
Do some documentaries.
Yeah, do some documentaries on the side.
I'm gonna reach out to him though, see if we can talk to him.
Yeah, that would be great. I would love to talk to him, because there's almost nothing about this film out there in terms of like process or background or anything, and I would love to know all that stuff, because I think it would be helpful for other documentary filmmakers to know this stuff.
Yeah,
you know, even if you're not going to do exactly the way he did it before, it gives you insight into somebody's process. Can always inform your own work.
If they just know how did he, you know, just the logistics of it, even how did he shoot all of those interviews and all of those different states, you know, just right before the.
How do you fund it? And if he did that, like, where do you get the money?
All right, well, I think that'll wrap it up.
Okay.
Anything else to say?
Nope.
All right.